Let's see. I think you once mentioned you were born on a ranch outside of town.
Well, I lived out there, but my parents came west in 1901, and my father came west on a hunting trip in 1901, but my parents both came from New York, and Pop's from Long Island, and Mother from Staten Island, both parts of New York City, but not Manhattan itself. It was more a residential part. And Pops came out on a hunting trip with some friends, and they went out to Vernal, and then they packed up in the mountains. And he fell in love with the country and thought only when he graduated from Yale, he didn't really want to be a businessman in New York. He, this looked very romantic to him. I think he was, I think he was just really sort of a dreamer, but he thought he would be a rancher. And so as soon as he graduated the next year from Yale, he came west and picked out a homestead site down on Sheep Creek. But then he found out that that had been reserved to be part of the Ashley National Forest, so he couldn't take a homestead there. But he went over several valleys to the north and found an old ranch that was for sale on Henry's Fork. And so he bought the ranch. I think it was probably for sale very cheap, and besides which he had to go east and borrow some money to get it. But he did borrow some money and got some friends interested in coming out with him. They just thought it would be a lark. They would be ranches for maybe 10 years at the most, and then settle down to doing something respectable afterwards. But they just thought this would be a wonderful adventure. And by the end of 10 years, the others had all left, and Pops was so in debt. He had to stay with it, but he liked it. I mean, he thought it was a wonderful life, and he liked being his own boss. And in the meantime, my mother had gone west with Pops' sister. They had gone to school together, and she had visited her ranch, and she thought it was a wonderful life, too. And so they were married, because her parents thought it was terrible. They said, why are you going to Bryn Mawr, and then decide to bury yourself out there, end up nowhere. And the mother said, well, this was her decision. She made it, and she stayed with it. But whenever she was going to have a baby, she would go east and stay with her parents in New York, because we didn't have any doctors within 65 miles. And there was a hospital here in North Springs, but that was 65 miles away, and we didn't have any doctors in the valley at that point. Lucerne Valley, where we lived, where our ranch was. That's where Manila, you know, Manila, but through the way down to there as well. We were in Linwood, which was just 5 miles west, 5 miles east of Manila. And so the town of Linwood, where we lived, well, it was really just a post office and a ranch, and that's about several ranches up and down the creek. That is all underwater now. It's all under Glen Gorge Dam. So it's Linwood Bay at this point. There weren't any good schools nearby, and there weren't any doctors or any help, so mother would go east to have her babies, and then we went to school in New York to save the grandparents. Mother did try 3 winters out in California, because she heard there were very good public schools in California. So she rented a house and had all 4 grandparents, who were all retired that night, all living with us, and she took us 4 children out there. Pops, of course, had to stay on the ranch to keep things going. And she did that for about 3 years. I suppose probably the grandparents paid the bills, because the ranch was in a very bad way. But anyway, we tried that, and then we decided to go back and go to school in New York and stay with the grandparents there. Mother's parents. And that was wonderful, because we would have all the advantage of going to good schools in New York and then being able to come out to the ranch for the summer. And we all worked in the hay field, and we had lots of visitors, and we had friends come out, and they all had to work too. And we had lots of cousins who would come out for the summer. That one summer there were 18 of us all summer long. Mother would send some of us out to the vegetable garden, pick peas for lunch, and somebody else. Boys would have to help with irrigating and with the haying, but it was really a lark for everybody. And then we could go fishing when there was time. And we went on camping trips, and that was all kinds of fun. You see, we had summer herds of sheep up in the mountains, and so we would pack up and stay at sheep.
The Uinta Mountains?
The Uinta Mountains, yeah. And so we would stay at sheep camp and fish and have a great time. Just 1 minute, I'll see if that coffee is.
Camp stove.
Uh-huh. Well, then as soon as I start doing something else, I always burn up when I'm cooking. I was baking a cake. Saturday was John's birthday, so I was baking a cake for his birthday, and then I went in to write a letter, and I forgot the cake for the beginning for an hour and a half. So it was not very
sweet.
It's happened so often, you think I would have learned. But I have a one-track mind.
He never learns from our mistakes. That's what we keep. That's what makes life so fun.
Uh huh. Well, let me see. I went to private schools in New York. My uncle was interested in a country day school there, and he was one of the trustees of it. And he was a lawyer in New York, and so. When we couldn't pay the tuition, he paid the tuition, which made it very handy. And so my sister and I both went to this private school, London Hall, on Staten Island, and lived with my grandparents. And then I went to Smith College, and I graduated from Smith in 1936. And I thought I might like to get into writing. I went to New York and applied for a job as a researcher on Time, Newsweek, and didn't get anywhere with it. But in the meantime, I went to the YWCA and in the evenings and had a wonderful time doing modern dance there. I'd been in the dance group when I was in college, and I loved dancing. And so I said, well, maybe I will study dancing instead. And my parents were wonderful. They let us follow any crazy ideas we might have. My sister went to Grand Central Art School in New York while I was, during this first year when I was trying to get a job. Well, I did have a job for a short time with Encyclopedia Britannica because they needed people fresh out of college who could look up things, look up answers to questions that people would write me. And you didn't have to know about the subject. All you had to do was know how to use a library to find the answers. And so I did work for them for a while, but they were about to close up shop in New York and move out to Chicago. So that was very short-lived there. I guess it's still in Chicago. But that was a good experience for a few months. And then the next year, my sister was going back to teach at a school where she taught before in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so I went with her and started studying dancing with Mary Starks, who I had seen dance when I was at Smith, and I liked her kind of modern dance. So I started working with her and danced in her group. Of course, we were definitely amateurs at that point. But she was professional. But I mean, her group were all amateurs, mostly school teachers, and well, there was one girl who worked in a spaghetti factory, and we were all kinds of a mixed group. And it was I just loved doing it. Of course, we weren't making any money on it whatsoever. I would accept $40 a month from my father on the ranch. and my sister would make up the rest. She was teaching. And so I had a wonderful time dancing. And it was impractical, but it was the one thing that I just loved to do. And then I got a few teaching jobs. So that made it a bit better. I was taught at Pine Manor Junior College in Virginia. and get the coffee.
I just ignore it.
Well, I don't have to do it all.
Like I said, this tape is going to be transcribed. I don't know if I can turn the actual tape in or not. But, so you were dancing and teaching at college, teaching dance at the college?
Pine Manor was in Wellesley, so you know, Wellesley, Massachusetts, and then I got a job at a college in Virginia, in Solomons, Virginia. But they were with the junior colleges. But then, after dancing for a while, well, I guess by about 1940, I was out on the ranch. I went back to ranch in summer. That was one lovely thing about teaching. You do have a summer as well. And I would always go back out to the ranch in the summer. And then when, after Pearl Harbor, my father was chairman of the draft board, and my brother enlisted, so he didn't have to draft him. But anyway, they were very short of men on the ranch. And so Pop said, well, how would you like to come and help me on the ranch? You and my sister Susie, too. And we thought that would be great. So we spent about 8 years on the ranch. And had a wonderful time out of it because we were allowed to do all the things that we hadn't been allowed to do when we were younger, because they were supposed to be boys' jobs. I mean, you know, driving the teams and actually pitching hay and that sort of thing, or bull raking, all those jobs that always been considered things just the boys did. Well, with no men around, they were glad to let us do it, and so we really had a lark out of it. We knew how to plow. Of course, I wasn't good at repairing machinery. When it broke down, we'd always have to get a man on the place to repair it. And I think they probably thought it was a pain in the neck. But and all the teeth had broken, the bull rope and things like that. But we had a good time because we really got to know our parents for the first time. And, you know, when you're young, you're sort of taken for granted. And then both being finished college and grown up, we could appreciate the parents a lot more and have a lot of fun there. So I was on the ranch until 1948. Oh, I was in the state legislature for a couple of years. My father thought it would be educational for me. And as usual, most of the men in the county were not interested in that because they were busy keeping the ranch going. Actually, he would have liked to do it, and he did do it later. But he had to keep the ranch going. And so he said, why don't you move to the legislature? And he took me around and did most of the talking for me. And so it wasn't hard to be elected since our county only had 400 residents. And nobody else wanted the job very much. I did have an opponent, but anyway, I did get elected to the legislature, and so I went down to Salt Lake for a couple of months, and that was fascinating, seeing what kind of bills were introduced. And now I'm going to get the coffee.
That was Salt Lake.
Yes, that was in Salt Lake. Yes. Well, I always have trouble with grounds, but I think this is going to be all right. Would you like a black sugar cream?
That's me. I don't know if I can mess it up. Just call the job. That's our food recipe for coffee. We take the biggest pot you got, open a 3 pound can of coffee, throw it in the bottom, fill it with water, bring it to a boil, let it stand for 5 minutes, throw it in the Marmite can container.
Well, I'm glad you aren't too fussy about it, because I just like strong coffee. grandson helped me make these yesterday. So if you find anything in them that shouldn't have been there, it's, it was just his idea.
So how many years were you in the legislature? Just for two?
I just was there for one session, and I mean, they just met every other year. So we had a special session the second year. But then I didn't run again because at that point I was more interested in marrying John. And so I decided that we were married in December of 1948. And I knew I couldn't do both, be in the Utah legislature and live and be a resident of Rusk, he's my own.
A difficult time.
Mm-hmm. And John made very clear that we both wanted to have a big family. He came from me. He was one of eight children. I was one of four. And we both wanted to have a family. He made it very clear that I was going to have to give up all ideas of any career on my own because I was going to be very busy. God willing, if we had bringing up a family. And I was ready for that by then.
So
I think it's much easier if you have whatever career you have before you get married. And then you don't mind spending time with the children.
So when you were in the legislature, is there anything big or momentous that stands out that happened while you were there? Was it?
No, they were all sort of 50 or more bills. This is an approved bill was approved by the, in other words, by the unions. And we did get a 2-year medical school started at the University of Utah. And of course, since then, it's gone into a 4-year medical school and the university hospital has been built since then, but at that time they were just starting a 2-year medical school, and then of course we visited all the state institutions, you know, the reform schools and them, and the penitentiary, and that was all pretty depressing.
Well, being Utah. A lot of people have this idea of Utah not being the fairly strong Mormon community,
mm-hmm.
being rather sexist along some of the lines of not wanting women to participate in a lot of public and that type of
mm-hmm.
members. Did you run into any problems while you were in the legislature?
No. There were about four women. I remember in the legislature, they were good to us. Now they didn't object. Of course, we were a minority, but they were. But they didn't. They didn't seem to mind.
So that was about. So that was between 1946 and 1948.
Mm-hmm. Then. When after John and I were married, because I moved to Rock Springs, and we lived down the building, all the apartments right close to the railroad. And I can remember the sound. The railroad had decided to pump sand in on the tracks because they were afraid that, you know, with the mines, that the railroad might subside into a coal mine. So they had these blowers blowing sand under the tracks all along in town here. I don't know how far out in the country they had to do it, but I guess probably just in town. So we would hear these sand blowers going all night long. And then, as I mentioned to you before, that I remember the mine whistles, because mines were so open at that point. You see, they closed in 1950, I think it was. And so you'd hear a mine whistle at 6 a.m. and I guess at noon, 6 p.m. Anyway, when it was time to change shifts. And everyone predicted, a lot of people predicted, that if they ever closed the coal mines, this would be a ghost town. And fortunately, with trauma, they were starting to develop trauma by then, so it wasn't a ghost town after all. And of course, there were people still in the livestock business too. And actually, things have improved a lot since then. The shopping was better in those days. I used to love to be able to telephone the Pacific Market and have groceries sent up, and they had, and nobody delivers anymore, but that was very easy. And they had some very nice stores right downtown here, I mean, right along Broadway and Main Street. So you could walk by, the stockbrokers carried everything, groceries and clothes, something else. It was a very good store, a department store. And good clothing stores. Actually, I think the stores were better then than they are now, but we had a big mall with lots of junk shops and some good ones. There have been certainly a lot of improvements in the town. I think it's a much more beautiful spot now. I mean, since they did all the planting, the Landua Drive, for instance, the grass and the trees that they put in there, and all of the improvements in the cemetery, much nicer. In fact, some of my friends got a special permission from Mayor West to ride their bicycles in the cemetery. Most kids aren't supposed to because they would be making a lot of noise. But these were my contemporaries, and they said they wanted a safe place to ride, but nobody would run over them and where they wouldn't be in anybody's way. And so he gave them a special dispensation to ride in the cemetery.
He wasn't afraid of them running over the grass.
No, they weren't worried about that. And then, of course, the college was... has been started since I moved to Rock Springs, and I think that's a great improvement. They started out with just night classes in the high school, and then they moved out to Reliance. You probably know this already, and they used Reliance High School because after the coal mines had been, they had this empty school building, the high school building out there, so the college used that. For a few years, and then they planned this campus up here on College Hill, and moved into that. So I think the college has made it a much more interesting place to live. Brought in a lot of new interest in the arts and in science too. And I think that we have some really good teachers there. I always wanted to live in a college town, and I had thought when I was growing up that Green River or Rock Springs would be the last place on earth I'd want to live, but it turned out to be much better. once I moved here, I found it was a lot more friendly and a lot more interesting place than I had thought it would be.
And what do you remember of Rock Springs growing up, or did you just pass, was it just some place you passed through on the train on your way?
Yeah, that was about it. We would catch the train in Green River. That was the closest place to the ranch. And I would always pray that we'd have such bad thunderstorms and such floods during September that we couldn't possibly go back to school, because I would much rather stay on the ranch. And quite often the road was washed out, but we could drive up around Burnt Fork and eventually get the railroad. So nothing would keep us from going back to school, so I always hoped it would. And then we'd just take the train back to Chicago and change trains in Chicago and on to New York. I liked it when I got to New York, because we had lots of relatives there, and I liked the school we went to, but hated leaving the ranch. The sound of railroad whistle always sounded so weary when we were leaving home. Oh, another improvement is changing to diesel engines from coal, because of course they were all coal drawn when I was growing up, and that was the dirtiest trip. Coal cinders just come pouring in the windows of the train. You know, we go out on the observation car and get an eye full of cinders. So, and they put on diesel engines, the trains, and the whole trip was much cleaner and much pleasanter.
Was it?
3 days and 3 nights.
That's including the change in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we generally have maybe two hours or something. How about a bit of coffee? Would you like a few grounds?
Yeah, I'll take a few grounds. You said when you first moved to Rock Springs, you lived down?
We lived down in the Brignoli Apartments, which was down on 3rd Street. And actually had a view of the had a view of the railroad. And then we moved up, and this was a family house, and John was born in this house. His parents moved here well before 1900. I guess it was probably about 1899. But John was born in this house, and his a brother and sister were born here. And so we moved up here in 1950. John's mother had died, and his father was still here. But he had to have nurses around the clock. He had a stroke and was quite sick. And so we moved up into the family house, and kept house for him. He had nurses, so I didn't have to do all the nursing work. But by that time, we had twins. It was a one-bedroom apartment, and we started out with twins, and then another one was a singleton was on the way, and so it was time to move out of the apartment. We knew that, and the family said, "Why don't you move into the family house?" He said, "You need more space than the rest of us don't." Well, it was quite sociable. Let me see. Mountain Fuel was going strong. The Mountain Fuel people all lived here in Rock Springs at that point. They had moved their headquarters to Salt Lake, and so they were always doing exploration around here, and. And there were some other oil companies that were working, and most of the sheep ranches, their families would live in Rock Springs for the winter time, so the kids could go to school, and then they'd go out on the ranches in summertime. And so there were a lot of ranch families living here, and of course there were lots of people connected with the coal mines. Now, Wardell Court used to be all, well, there was a company apartments over there. Well, I guess it's called the Clubhouse, but the place that's now apartments in Wardell Court, do you know that?
Mm.
That's right. Well, anyway, there were a lot of people from the Union Pacific coal mines living here, the ones who were running it, and also a lot of railroad people living here. So, There was a good deal of social life, and it was quiet, you know. Just before the big influx of people, there weren't very many changes going on. There wasn't very much building. And same stores, we stayed in business for a long time before we had shopping malls, but the rent is high and people and the stores keep changing hands. And of course we were interested in schools, having four children, and John was on the school board, and then he was on the college board. And we wanted to see what was changes there.
When did the big influx of people in chain start to really happen? It was noticeable here.
Well, let me see.
I mean, everybody knows about the boom in the mid to late 70s when CBS News and everybody got here and made this out to be the roughest, toughest town in the West. But
yes.
Were there other small booms before then that kept coming and going, or was that sort of...
Well, not a building trend
that sort of hit a peak at that point.
I think this hit a peak at that point because it was really fairly quiet when I first came here, and then of course when the coal mines closed, why they thought everything was going to be a ghost town. But then a lot of the miners got jobs mining the soda ash mines instead, so it wasn't nearly as bad as she might have thought. And most of the miners had saved money. They all had savings accounts in banks, and they weren't as destitute as you might have thought, because most of them were economical and they weren't used to boom times, and so they had saved their money, and so we didn't have a very bad time. And I suppose most of the building booming was in the 70s.
Did it come to a surprise to you to see people hot springs on 60 Minutes?
Yes, it was horrible because it made the town look so black. Friends of mine from the East, when college friend who was living in Florida wrote and said, "What's a nice girl like you living doing living in Rock Springs?" But I think any small town, almost any town, has some black corners which can be painted pretty badly if you want to make a sensational story out of it. Yes, I would. I wouldn't want to be interviewed by Dan. Saying the wrong thing if you're the least bit nervous.
We were talking earlier, about during the summers, all the relatives from back east coming out and spending the summers. I guess your father looked at it as cheap labor, and y'all looked at it as a great way to something amazingly different to spend the summer doing on Staten Island.
Yes, it really was fun all around, and Pops always saw to it that there was enough pleasure involved, you know, enough time to go fishing and whatnot, so that nobody thought it. And he thought it was a good way to entertain all the cousins and also to reciprocate for all the times when we visited them. Would spend, you know, from Is it Barry's cousin's Christmas vacation, that sort of thing?
Any of them decide to come out here to stay after?
No, none of them decided to come out to stay. My brother, my oldest brother, had 1 year of ranching out here. And the year after he graduated from here, just as my father did. And he came out, he graduated in 1928. And then he came out the ranch that winter. It was the worst winter in history, I think. I mean, as far as snow and ice. And we couldn't get out to the ranch in trucks at all, because the roads were all closed with drifted snow. And so they'd have to haul corn out for the sheep, because you have to give them a lot of extra feed. And they'd have to drive along down on the river to get to the ranch. And the river was frozen over, of course, except every so often there would be a hole in it, and the trucks would crash through and fall in the hole. So that was a really terrible winter. And either my father or my brother would have to ride on the truck to persuade the truck driver to risk it, and they had to do it because they had to get some feed to the sheep. And nobody was killed, but they did get dumped in the river a couple of times. And so after that one winter out here, my brother decided that no matter how smart you were or how hard you worked, you could lose your shirt at ranching in one bad winter. And so he went back east again. And by then, of course, the Depression was on. And he got a job at JMA Company in Hartford, Connecticut. They made gold alloys, and he could live on $25 a week. And so he took a job with them. And he stayed with them all through the years. And got to be president of the company, and then finally when he reached retirement, he was the chairman of the board. And so after he retired from that, and after he retired from business and his wife had died, he came west again. And he had built a cabin for my father up in the Uintas near Flaming Gorge. Because when our old cabin, our old ranch went underwater, progress, but it was the end for me. And my brother said, well, it's not the end. We'll move the old cabins up on high, and we'll build a new cabin. And I'll retire to it, and I can retire. And in the meantime, you can be enjoying it. So Keith designed a cabin up in Greendale, and he moved the old cabins from the old ranch up there, because they were very... they were old trapper's cabins. Jack Robertson was one of Jim Bridges' trappers, beaver trappers. And he had these two cabins on the ranch, and my father added on to it, but he used one of them for a dining room and one of them for a bedroom, and then he put a big kitchen between the two, and then added some more bedrooms and living room beyond that. But they were... the state of Utah wanted to preserve them. In fact, they wanted to take them down Salt Lake because they were there when the first survey went through in 1830, I think it was, at Utah State. And, Utah was the state. Well, anyway, when the first survey went through, they were there on the map, so they decided they were a good historical site and they would keep them. So, we said, well, we won't destroy them, but we'll move them up to high land, and you can put a plaque on them if you like. So they put a plaque on them. This was Jim Bridges' cabin. It was on Henry's Fork, but had to be moved because that was being flooded out by the Flaming Gorge Dam. And when we were going to move the cabins, we thought we'd have to take them all apart because we thought they couldn't possibly stand up being picked up and put on the back of the truck. They were all hand-hewn cottonwood logs, you know, this wide. And they were so neatly dovetailed, of course it was all hand labor, and you could see the axe marks all over them, but they were built so soundly that they held together, and we had to put in some new daubing afterwards, but that was all. And we moved the cabins up by truck, and put them as sort of wings on each end of the new house that my daughter built. So we've enjoyed that place a lot. And Pops could look over the country we used to graze sheep on, but he didn't own sheep anymore, he sold out. But he could see where we used to raise sheep, and we could look over the top of Bear Mountain, where they have planted some mountain sheep. Nobody's allowed to go up there because they don't want the mountain sheep to be disturbed. But they come down the river to drink. We saw them last summer. We took a boat out on the boards. We saw them all drinking down in the river, and that's where we used to have a dry herding sometimes.
The only member of the family, other than your father and mother, that got the defective gene above the part of the country.
My sister said, well, she taught in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then she taught in Virginia too, in Chatham, Virginia. But she liked it out on the ranch, and she likes to paint, so. She did quite a bit of painting, and so she liked this part of the country too. And then she married an engineer at FMC, so she lived in Green River. And our youngest brother, well, he was in 1941, he entered the army, but then when he got out of the army, he settled on Salt Lake. Lives there. So really, it was only the oldest brother who still wanted to go east. But then this was always home. He loved it out here, and he was always so enthusiastic about the country. He'd come out every time he had a vacation. But he didn't think there was any place to make a living.
Were there some differences you could tell between the people you went to school with, people you went to school with back east and people you went out there? Or was it all pretty much?
Oh, I think everybody is provincial in his own way. You can be a provincial New Yorker, or you can be a provincial Wyoming. But I think that I think you can find congenial people anywhere you go.
During the time that you lived in Rock Springs, then, you know, from 1948 and so on, you mentioned that, you know, you noticed the change with the new now whistles, or the whistles made. And what other changes have you noticed in day-to-day life? Things that you notice and can remember is, you know, changing points or points that things change, like, you know, 30, 40 years span.
Well, of course, they built more schools and it was handy in those days because my children up to Yellowstone School, and then they went to junior high right down the street here. And then they went to high school, and what's now East Junior High. So you could walk, and they could walk everywhere. They didn't need a ride. And the schoolette system was developed after my children got through school, but they had an hour to come home for lunch. And so I think that made a difference in everybody's schedule, because we always took it for granted. Children would be home for lunch, and well, John was always coming home for lunch. And so that's, of course, different from cities where nobody goes home for lunch. And I suppose most people don't, a lot of people don't go home for lunch. Here in Rock Springs now, but in those days, everybody did.
No McDonald's?
No McDonald's, no. And I think a lot more people have planted trees and grass and flowers. I mean, I think the town has improved and considerably in looks, and they've cleaned up some of the dumps. I think it's a very good program they have, making kids get out and pick up bottles if they've broken the law, if they have to go out and I think the economy has been better here since the days when John was growing up, for instance. People always assumed that if you're ambitious, you would leave the town and look for work somewhere else. And then especially during the boom times, there were more and more jobs opening up right here. That was definitely an improvement. Didn't affect mine because I didn't go down K Street much. Yeah. No, it was just a bit rowdier, and you wouldn't recognize everybody on the street. I mean, it used to be you knew everybody almost in town, and then there was this big influx, and you didn't recognize most of the people who drove by.
Going to start staying bigger than one anonymous city.
I don't know how anybody can forecast the future. I think that was a big mistake they made up at the college when they thought we were going to grow to be 50,000 people. Resources here, so there'll always be some economy. I think they'll get back to more oil and gas exploration. They'll make more use of the coal again, and I'd much rather have to use coal than atomic energy. And take out the pollutants from the air, so I think that there's really a lot of future for the industries that we have here. I would like to see ranchers able to make a living again, and it's pretty hard hard to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But things have always gone in cycles, and I think they will continue to.
I've probably got enough.